Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we end today's show talking about what I mentioned at the top, our heavy hearts, as we read the news out of Arizona. 19 firefighters dead trying to battle the Yarnell Hill fire in the central part of that state. It's the largest number of firefighters killed in one wildfire since a 1933 blaze in California, and the largest loss of firefighters since the 9/11 attacks here in New York. So let's talk about the life of a forest firefighter with Dick Mangan, now retired from the U.S. Forest Service, where he worked as the fire program leader at the Missoula Technology Development Center, trying to build the equipment that keeps forest firefighters safe. He joins us from Missoula, Montana. Dick, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York, and sorry to be talking to you under these circumstances.
Yes, thank you, Brian. Yes, not a good day for sure.
And listeners, we have a few minutes to take your calls. In particular, we want to hear from firefighters and retired firefighters. We know that battling a fire in a city and battling a forest fire can be very different. But still, if you're a firefighter and you want to share your thoughts today or talk about life on the front lines or tell our listeners something they may not know about firefighting, the phones are open, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Dick, let me start by asking you a very naive city dweller question, which is this. Given technological developments, safety equipment, the use of planes, how is it that you can even die in forest fires in the year 2013?
Well, you're still dealing with a force of Mother Nature. I'd compare it very much to the three storm chasers that died down in Oklahoma last month. Oklahoma or Texas, even though they had the most sophisticated equipment out there, nature still does strange things to you sometimes. And you have to recognize that we're dealing with a pretty imperfect level of knowledge sometimes and a very short decision space of what to do next. So we don't know all the different fuel conditions, the terrain, the weather conditions we're experiencing, the effects of that terrain on wind flow and things like that.
And what was the special training that these firefighters, who the national media is calling elite firefighters, and I think that's probably the first time that many people have been exposed to that term, what's the training or equipment or whatever else that makes them elite? You know, we hear about elite special forces in a military context, not usually with respect to firefighters. So what makes these firefighters elite?
Well, the crew, the hotshot crew that this number of fatalities occurred on, it's part of a national standard which requires, first of all, that about 80% of everybody on the 20-person crew has to have at least one season's previous experience. In addition to that, every year they spend an 80-hour block, two full weeks before they even start their fire season, training again on more sophisticated areas of fire weather, fire behavior, strategy and tactics, the use of tools, communications techniques, coordination with aircraft. Probably a lot more intensity than a regular 20-person crew or an engine crew would have scattered throughout the west of the United States.
So what went wrong? Can you tell in this particular case?
No, it's way too early, Brian, to make any guesses on that. The four things that we really focus on to keep firefighters safe is an acronym that started back in Arizona in 1990 when we had a fire called the Dude Fire, which killed six firefighters. And the solutions that we came up with was if you pay attention to four critical things, one, having a lookout, secondly, having good communications, third, having an escape route to get out of the area, and then fourth, having a safety zone where no matter what the fire is doing, you're going to be in a position where you will not suffer burn injuries. So it uses the acronym LCES. That'll be one of the things that probably will be looked at in the aftermath of this, is to see, did they, in fact, have good communications with somebody who could see what the fire was doing? Were they able to share that information back and forth? And did they have a way, first of all, to get out of the area? And then secondly, was there an area big enough and cleared of any burning vegetation or burnable vegetation that they could have been safe with the intensity of the fire that they probably experienced yesterday?
Dennis in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Dennis, thank you for calling.
Yes, hello.
Are you a New York City firefighter?
I am. I'm a fire lieutenant.
Well, thank you for your service. And what do you want to say?
Well, I've been in the field for almost 35 years. I'm an urban firefighter, and I know nothing about rural firefighting. But I just wanted to send my support to those people and my gratitude for what they're doing out there, too. You know, urban and rural firefighting are very different, but they're also very the same. And I was just listening to the gentleman talk about their safety plan, about having a way out and egress and good communications being mandatory. And it's the same thing, you know, in urban, you know, and it's all about being able to deal with things that are unpredictable. And it's sort of ironic because the wind also has killed firemen in buildings in New York City. You know, we have issues with the wind blowing in and intensifying the fire. And it just becomes completely like blowtorch and unruly. And I'm sure they have the same thing. They're just dealing on like a scale that I can't even understand of thousands of acres. I mean, you know, I go into a building 20 by 40. That seems like enough for me.
Yeah. How different. Dick, anything you want to say to Dennis?
No, I just appreciate the fact that we have to interface with the urban folks all the time. I had the opportunity back in the 90s to go back to Long Island, New York on the Sunrise Fire, and we worked very closely with a bunch of folks from the different departments back there that had not had much exposure to wildland, and they picked up really quick and worked very well with us.
Dennis, thanks a lot. Be safe out there. Mark in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually also a New York City firefighter, also assigned to Brooklyn. And I just definitely want to express my condolences and support to my brothers out west. And they got some very tough conditions with the weather. And I think it's very unfortunate. And it's a very dangerous job. And it takes something like this for people to realize how dangerous it can be. We're the first to go, last to know in terms of conditions and everything. And in some cases, we know we're taken for granted. And when we try to stand up for staffing needs and hiring requirements and things that we want to have available to us to keep our service strong, we're kind of put in the back seat until something happens. And then, you know, everybody loves to bury a dead hero. So it's unfortunately, hopefully the brothers out there will stay strong and, you know, we'll work through this as a fire service community. And hopefully, you know, it will continue to happen. It's a very dangerous job, both wildland and urban firefighting. And hopefully we'll just continue to train and serve as best we can. Thank you.
Mark, what is it that you need out there? If you're saying this is, you know, if this is the opportunity, even though it's born of tragedy, for people to pay attention for a minute, what do you need?
Well, I think in most cases in the city in the past few years, they've taken away the fifth firefighter on a lot of the engine companies, which greatly, if we have that extra firefighter, would greatly increase our ability to effectively put water on a fire and, you know, to operate more safely in terms of our safety and quicker in terms of getting water on a fire, making the fire environment possibly a little more habitable for someone with or individuals that we might be looking for. And staffing has been cut, obviously in New York City, but across the nation as, you know, budgets are getting tighter and tighter, and we're doing much more with less than we used to have. You know, we're doing upwards of, you know, a million or 2 million runs a year in the city, I think is a number in the ballpark. And they're very, you know, the more that we cut services that we need, the more these types of things may continue to occur with building construction codes changing and things like that. It's getting very tough out there, but we're still going to rise to the challenge as we always have.
And you will. And be safe out there. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, another few minutes with Dick Mangan, now retired from the U.S. Forest Service, as we talk about the fire in Arizona, the wildfire that took the lives of 19 firefighters yesterday. Dick, not to be graphic, but what happens on the front lines of a forest fire like this when things go wrong? Do they die of smoke inhalation, burns, falling trees? Is it possible to say?
You know, generally, in a burnover situation, the fatality occurs from damage to the respiratory system. And it's not what you call exactly smoke inhalation, but it's the fact that the heat damage to your lungs and respiratory system just shuts down and death comes very quickly. And then usually the burn injuries occur after that. So essentially the people are not burning to death, and there's not, you know, that tremendous amount of pain that occurs if the respiratory system is damaged. However, if they're inside of a fire shelter and they are protecting their respiratory system by keeping their face in the dirt and trying to breathe a little bit of cool, clean air, then burn injuries could, in fact, become the cause of death. And that'll all have to be determined after the fact, of course.
How good is the best equipment to protect the lungs to the maximum extent possible? And what percentage of firefighters have that best equipment?
There really is not any real good respiratory protection equipment for wildland firefighters compared to the structural folks. But you have to understand that the area that we're working in, generally we're working on steep hills, timbered environment, working a 16-hour shift away from the roads oftentimes, where there's no self-contained breathing apparatus that runs out of air in 10 or 15 minutes and that weighs an additional 40 or 50 pounds. So, you know, the idea in wildland firefighting is you give up ground in order to gain control. The intent is never to be right up against the fire's edge.
And so in our last 20 seconds, and that's all we have, there is an argument that goes that fire is a natural process, and if you can manage small fires in an area, you won't have to put people and resources at risk in massive fires. It's a natural process. Just let it burn instead of put people in harm's way when you're dealing with a forest fire as opposed to a neighborhood fire. What do you think about that real quick?
In certain circumstances, that's a good philosophy. But when you're in late June, early July in Arizona under the drought conditions, it's probably not the best way to do business.
Dick Mangan, now retired from the U.S. Forest Service. Thanks for giving us a few minutes today. And again, our hearts go out to everybody in your field.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.